the Book of Judges. It's a tale of chaos unleashed, of violence unchained, and of a moral compass spinning wildly out of control. Ancient Israel's story? Perhaps. But as we peel back the pages, we'll find a mirror reflecting our own tumultuous times. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Sound familiar? Well, join us over the next few weeks as we study the Book of Judges, ancient wisdom for modern chaos. Our story begins now.
Judges 11. Jephthah the Gileadite was a mighty warrior. His father was Gilead, his mother was a prostitute. Gilead's wife also bore him sons, and when they were grown up, they drove Jephthah away, saying, "You are not going to get any inheritance in our family, because you are the son of another woman." So Jephthah fled from his brothers and settled in the land of Tov, where a gang of scoundrels gathered around him and followed him. Sometime later, when the Ammonites were fighting against Israel, the elders of Gilead went to get Jephthah from the land of Tov. "Come," they said, "be our commander, so we can fight the Ammonites." Jephthah said to them, "Didn't you hate me and drive me from my father's house? Why do you come to me now when you're in trouble?" The elders of Gilead said to him, "Nevertheless, we are turning to you now. Come with us to fight the Ammonites, and you will be head over all of us who live in Gilead." Jephthah answered, "Suppose you take me back to fight the Ammonites, and the Lord gives them to me. Will I really be your head?" The elders of Gilead replied, "The Lord is our witness. We will certainly do as you say." So Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and commander over them. And he repeated all his words before the Lord in Mizpah. Then Jephthah sent messengers to the Ammonite king with the question, "What do you have against me that you have attacked my country?" The king of the Ammonites answered Jephthah's messengers, "When Israel came up out of Egypt, they took away my land from the Arnon to the Jabbok, all the way to the Jordan. Now, give it back peacefully." Jephthah sent back messengers to the Ammonite king, saying, "This is what Jephthah says. Israel did not take the land of Moab or the land of the Ammonites. But when they came up out of Egypt, Israel went through the wilderness to the Red Sea and on to Kadesh. Then Israel sent messengers to the king of Edom, saying, 'Give us permission to go through your country.' But the king of Edom would not listen. They sent also to the king of Moab, and he refused. So Israel stayed at Kadesh. Next, they traveled through the wilderness, skirted the lands of Edom and Moab, passed along the eastern side of the country of Moab, and camped on the other side of the Arnon. They did not enter the territory of Moab, for the Arnon was its border. Then Israel sent messengers to Sihon, king of the Amorites, who ruled in Heshbon, and said to him, 'Let us pass through your country to our own place.' Sihon, however, did not trust Israel to pass through his territory. He mustered all his troops and encamped at Jahaz and fought with Israel. Then the Lord, the God of Israel, gave Sihon and his whole army into Israel's hands, and they defeated them. Israel took over all the land of the Amorites who lived in that country, capturing all of it from the Arnon to the Jabbok and from the desert to the Jordan. Now, since the Lord, the God of Israel, has driven the Amorites out before his people Israel, what right have you to take it over? Will you not take what your god Chemosh gives you? Likewise, whatever the Lord our God has given us, we will possess. Are you any better than Balak, son of Zippor, king of Moab? Did he ever quarrel with Israel or fight with them? For 300 years, Israel occupied Heshbon, Aroer, the surrounding settlements, and all the towns along the Arnon. Why didn't you retake them during that time? I've not wronged you, but you are doing me wrong by waging war against me. Let the Lord, the judge, decide the dispute this day between the Israelites and the Ammonites." The king of Ammon, however, paid no attention to the message Jephthah sent him. Then the spirit of the Lord came on Jephthah. He crossed Gilead and Manasseh, passed through Mizpah of Gilead, and from there he advanced against the Ammonites. And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord, "If you give the Ammonites into my hands, whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return in triumph for the Ammonites will be the Lord's, and I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering." Then Jephthah went over to fight the Ammonites, and the Lord gave them into his hands. He devastated 20 towns from Aroer to the vicinity of Minnith, as far as Abel Keramim. Thus Israel subdued Ammon. When Jephthah returned to his home in Mizpah, who should come out to meet him but his daughter, dancing to the sound of tambourines? She was an only child. Except for her, he had neither son nor daughter. When he saw her, he tore his clothes and cried, "Oh no, my daughter, you have brought me down, and I am devastated. I have made a vow to the Lord that I cannot break." "My father," she replied, "you have given your word to the Lord. Do to me as you promised, now that the Lord has avenged you of your enemies, the Ammonites. But give me this one request," she said. "Give me 2 months to roam the hills and weep with my friends, because I will never marry." "You may go," he said, and he let her go for 2 months. She and her friends went into the hills and wept because she would never marry. After the 2 months, she returned to her father, and he did to her as he had vowed, and she was a virgin. From this comes the Israelite tradition that each year the young women of Israel go out for 4 days to commemorate the daughter of Jephthah, the Gileadites. So I need to imagine for a moment. If every word you spoke today was projected onto a giant screen that works, a giant screen that everyone could see, every single word you've ever said, every casual comment, every heated response, every promise, every excuse, what would they reveal about you? Now, studies show the average person speaks about 16,000 words a day. That's like writing a small book each and every single day. But if someone could read that book, not just hear the words, but could truly see what those words reveal about your heart, what would they discover? Would they find someone who genuinely trusts God? Or would they find someone who seeks to protect, to control, to manipulate with their words? I mean, this passage is shocking, isn't it? It's a shocking story in the book of Judges. It's a story all about words, words that seem harmless, words that seem even pious, but end up revealing deep truths about a man's heart and his view of God. I mean, we might all know the saying, "Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me." I mean, the story of Jephthah challenges that, doesn't it? Words in this story don't just hurt, they destroy. And they reveal. They teach us a hard truth about ourselves. So here's the question we're thinking about as we look at this story. What do your words reveal? What do your words reveal? You see, our words, they don't just communicate information. They expose what's going on in our hearts. You can think of them like a spiritual x-ray. Just as an x-ray reveals what is broken inside our bodies, our words reveal what is broken in our hearts. They show what we value. They show who we trust. They show who we fear. Words can be tools of faith or weapons of destruction. Words can boost our ego, sideline God, and lead to disaster. Our words reveal what we truly think about God. And that's what we see in Jephthah's story. His words, whether spoken in negotiation, spoken in vow, or spoken in despair, expose his view of God. And the tragedy is they reveal a man who trusts himself more than the God who saves. Let's have a look at the text, shall we? First thing to see, our words reflect who we truly serve. That's verses 1 to 11. So in verses 1 to 11, we're introduced to Jephthah, the main human character in this passage. And the thing you need to know about Jephthah is that he is, above all, a talker. He says far more than he actually does in this story. And most of the time when he speaks, his words are totally unnecessary. Even his name gives us a clue about his character. You see, the name Jephthah, it comes from the word meaning to open. It's as if the author's inviting us to pay attention to how he opens his mouth and what that reveals. Later, there's a play on that word as he tragically sees the opening of his house. But for now, we need to keep an eye on his words. So what are we told about him? We're told he's a Gileadite, and he is a mighty warrior from the east hills of the Jordan. And there's echoes of Gideon there, mighty warrior. And his father was Gilead. And you get the shock, don't you? His mother was a prostitute. And then even more than that, the shock of verse 2, Gilead's wife also bore. You see the situation there? This situation, it doesn't just tell us about Jephthah's background. This situation is telling us what the spiritual state of Israel is at this point. What are prostitutes doing in God's land? I mean, back in Judges chapter 8, we read that Israel were prostituting themselves to the Baals. That's the same word used here. And in many ways, Jephthah here is reflecting the nation as a whole. They have turned away from God's words, and they have compromised with idolatry. You could even say that Jephthah here is a product of idolatry. And we see the brokenness even in Jephthah's family. His half-brothers, verse 2, reject him outright. You are not going to get any inheritance in our family, they say, because you're the son of another woman. You see, this rejection, it isn't just cruel. It reflects the broader spiritual decay in Israel. God's law protects inheritance, even for the children of, well, let's say, less than ideal circumstances. But here, Jephthah's brothers, well, they're ignoring God's word to protect their own interests. So what does he do? Verse 3, he flees to the land of Tov. Tov means good. He's fleeing to a land whose name is good. But what does he do? Well, he surrounds himself with bad company. I mean, it's the mirror of Israel's compromise, isn't it? They've gone into a good land, and what they've done? They become scoundrels. But then, verses 6 to 11, the same people who rejected him now come to beg for his help. Have a look down at verse 6. They say to him, come, be our commander so we can fight the Ammonites. But Jephthah's response, verse 7, is biting. Didn't you hate me? Didn't you drive me away? And now you come to me in your distress? You hear the sarcasm in Jephthah's voice? You what? But notice what happens next, verse 8. The elders of Gilead said to him, nevertheless, we are turning to you now. Come with us to fight the Ammonites, and you'll be head over all of us who live in Gilead. I want you to focus in on that word turning. Just look at it for a moment. See, when they say the word turning there, that is the same word used for returning to God. But their actions, they don't show that's true, do they? They're just desperate. And Jephthah doesn't reject them outright, does he? No, he haggles with them. Will I really be your head, verse 9? And they promise, the Lord is our witness. And with that, the deal is done. You see what's happening here? The elders' words reveal who they truly serve. They're not turning to Jephthah because they see him as God's chosen deliverer. They're just looking out for themselves. And Jephthah here, well, his words are all about securing the best deal for himself. In fact, if you were here last week, this conversation might sound a bit familiar. You see, in Judges chapter 10, Israel and God had the same conversation. With exactly the same number of speaking parts between them. And Israel's words there to God were hollow. They were shaped by self-interest. And the elders' conversation here, well, it just matches the same pattern. But the big difference is, where God rejected the empty words, Jephthah jumps at the chance for power and status. There's our point, isn't it? Our words reflect who we truly serve. Just think about how often words in our world are shaped by self-interest. Our promises that are made, oaths that are sworn. It's always done with the what's in it for me attitude. And sadly, it's not just out there in the world, is it? It's in the church as well. See, how often do we use words to manipulate rather than to trust? Do we use prayer to get what we want when we want it? Or are we surrendering to God's will, whatever your will is, Lord? Do our words reveal faith, or do our words reveal self-reliance? Who do your words say you serve? Is it God, or is it yourself? Or with the deal done, the inauguration's happened, Jephthah now moves straight to business, signing those executive orders. In verses 12 to 28, we see another negotiation, this time between Jephthah and the king of Ammon. And these words reveal something else. Our words reveal our view of God. Our words reveal our view of God. Have a look down at verse 12. Jephthah begins with a question. Why are you attacking us? And the king responds, well, Israel's taking our land unlawfully and we want it back. So Jephthah replies by recounting Israel's history. He draws on the Exodus story to explain why the land belongs to Israel. Now, at first glance, it might seem that he's a skilled negotiator. It might seem that he's a good statesman building a strong case. You could imagine him in the modern-day courtroom sifting through the history books to win the territorial debate. He might sound like a good and savvy speaker, but he is a terrible theologian. He knows the facts, he knows the history, but he's missed the point. For instance, have a look down at verse 21. Then the Lord, the God of Israel, gave Sihon and his whole army into Israel's hands, and they defeated them. Israel took over all the land of the Amorites who lived in that country. I mean, it sounds good, doesn't it? Jephthah acknowledges God's role in Israel's history. But does he really? Does Israel really acknowledge that? Is this genuine? Or is it just lip service? Is it just using God's name to strengthen an argument? But then we hit verses 23 and 24 where Jephthah says this. Now, since the Lord, the God of Israel, has driven the Amorites out before his people Israel, what right have you to take it over? Will you not take what your God Chemosh gives you? Likewise, whatever the Lord our God has given us, we will possess. Now, first, it sounds like Jephthah is connecting us to Deuteronomy chapter 2. But the moment that you compare the two, Deuteronomy 2 says this. When you come to the Ammonites, do not harass them or provoke them to war, for I will not give you possession of any land belonging to the Ammonites. I have given it as a possession to the descendants of Lot. Did you hear the difference? It's subtle, but it's key. Deuteronomy says, the Lord gave the Ammonites their land. He can do that because he's the creator. He parcels out land as he sees fit. What does Jephthah say in Judges 11? Jephthah claims that a god called Chemosh, a pagan god, has given the Ammonites their land. Do you see that? Do you see the irony there? This is like someone today going, well, maybe Jesus is God, and at the same time, maybe Buddha's God, and maybe at the same time, he's just another higher power. What's the difference? Jephthah here in chapter 11 is reducing the infinite personal God of the Bible to just another option on the spiritual menu. Exactly what Israel's been doing through Judges. He sounds exactly of the culture around him. It's a perfect picture of how Israel has spent years drifting away from God. You see, here our point. Our words reveal our view of God. Jephthah thinks he's just another one to pick from. And what about us? I mean, just think about the way you speak about God for a moment. When you speak about God, do you feel sorry for the person you're speaking to? Do you show confidence in his power, in his sovereignty, in his goodness? Or do your words sound confused or compromised or mistrusting? See, like Jephthah, we are tempted to treat God as a local deity, someone we can manipulate, someone we can bargain with. Do we adapt our view of who God is in the things we say to fit what culture around us says? Do we soften? Do we change his truth when it suits us? You see, our words matter because they expose our theology. They reveal whether we see God as he truly is, or as something more small, something more manageable. So what do your words reveal about God? There is one thing that Jephthah does get right. Have a look down at verse 27. Jephthah gets right that the Lord is judge. Let the Lord, the judge, decide the dispute this day between the Israelites and the Ammonites. Here's a fun fact from Judges for you. The only person who is actually called a judge using the noun judge is the Lord. Whatever else is going on in this book, one of the key points is all the way through, God is the judge. And he is the one who does what is right in his own eyes. That's what happens. Do you remember Jephthah's name? It means to open. Tragic irony coming up. His words are going to open a door to destruction rather than deliverance. And we hear that darkest moment, verses 29 to 40. Here is the devastating truth. Our words reveal our trust of God. Verse 29. Then the Spirit of the Lord came on Jephthah. He crossed Gilead and Manasseh. He passed through Mizpah of Gilead. And from there he advanced against the Ammonites. Now at this point of Judges, we might think we're back on course. The Spirit of the Lord comes upon someone. We know the victory is about to come. Wham, bam, job's done. But then we get this addition, verse 30. Jephthah opens his mouth again. Jephthah made a vow to the Lord, if you give the Ammonites into my hands, whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return in triumph from the Ammonites will be the Lord's, and I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering. Let's be clear. That there is not an act of faith. That there is not rash. That there is not an accident. This is an act of pure manipulation. What sort of judge does Jephthah think God is? See, Jephthah doesn't trust God. Jephthah doesn't believe that God is with him, so Jephthah bargains. Jephthah tries to twist God's arm. He tries to guarantee the outcome. And here's the terrifying part. He sees God exactly like the other gods of the nations surrounding Israel. He sees the Lord as a deity to be bought, to be bargained with, to be appeased through horrific sacrifice. This is not the God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. This is a God that Jephthah has crafted in his imagination. A transactional deity who could be negotiated with, who could be persuaded by the most shocking of offerings. Do you remember how earlier Jephthah casually mentioned Chemosh? Well, now he's acting like someone who worships him. Now he's acting like someone who follows him. The God of Israel, who repeatedly demonstrates his desire for mercy, for relationship, for justice, has been reduced to another local deity who's going to be impressed by human sacrifice. Well, the battle commences, and it's over in two verses. Deliverance from one of the two enemies, and that's where the curtain falls, usually. That's where we wish the curtain did fall, isn't it? But we sadly follow Jephthah home. Just notice Jephthah now has a home. He was homeless, now he's got a home. But as he comes home, we're told about his daughter. His daughter's waiting at the window. She gets sight of her conquering father. She grabs her tambourine. She turns the door handle and he runs out to her dad. The only child of the home, waiting for her daddy to return. It's a father with three girls. I can feel it. Can you? Verse 35. When he saw her, he tore his clothes and cried, "Oh no, my daughter, you have brought me down, and I am devastated. I have made a vow to the Lord that I cannot break." Notice the self-servingness of those words. You have brought me down. I am devastated. I have made a vow. There's no, "I'm so sorry for what I've done. Maybe we can change it." No. Even in this moment, Jephthah's focus isn't on his daughter. It isn't on God. It is on himself, isn't it? What does this vow reveal? Well, it shows us that Jephthah's view of God has been shaped by those around him. He thinks of God like the Canaanites' gods, the ones who demand human sacrifice for a favour. And the result is heartbreaking, isn't it? His daughter, his only child, dies childless. Jephthah opens his mouth to open the door to his own destruction. The words of his brothers, "You will get no inheritance," come true. He loses his future, he loses his lineage, he loses his inheritance. Verse 39, explicitly, his daughter dies childless. But Jephthah does get a future, doesn't he? Do you see that? What is Jephthah remembered for? Verse 40. From this comes the Israelite tradition, that each year the young women of Israel go out for 4 days to commemorate the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite. Jephthah's legacy, what is left behind, is a cautionary tale. He's remembered not for his victory, but for the devastating consequences of his words. Of his words that revealed his lack of trust in God. Because our words reveal our trust of God. So again, how often do we try to bargain with God rather than trusting him? How often do our prayers sound like negotiations rather than surrendering to his will? The story of Jephthah warns us of the cost of misplaced trust. His words, they lead to destruction. See, God does not call us to prove ourselves or to make deals with him. He calls us to trust him completely. So what do your words reveal? Do they show a heart that truly trusts God, or a heart that's trying to control him? This warning is etched in biblical history. Our words are never neutral. Every time we open our mouth, we're revealing something profound. Not just information, but the very landscape of our hearts, the spiritual x-ray that shows what's going on inside. Jephthah thought he was negotiating with God. Instead, he was revealing his complete misunderstanding of who God is. So here's something really applicable. This week, I want to challenge each of us. Pay attention. Really pay attention to your words. What are your words revealing? When you're talking about your challenges, your dreams, your deepest fears, are they revealing a heart that truly, genuinely trusts God? Or are you trying to manipulate your way through life? Are your prayers authentic conversations with a loving God or transactional contracts with a distant deity? Do you approach God like a hard-nosed businessman to be bargained with or as a loving father that you can trust? Listen carefully this week, not just to what you say, but how you say it. Watch for those moments when your words accidentally expose what you truly believe about God. Because our words are never just words. They're windows, crystal clear windows into our hearts. But the beauty of the gospel is this, isn't it? When you discover those words of manipulation, those words of mistrust, there is a more simple, there's a more powerful truth. God's grace is infinitely more wonderful, infinitely bigger, infinitely better than our words. So we can turn to the Lord and ask for his grace and seek to live his way, trusting him, because that's what he calls for, because he's a loving father.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. Any questions can be sent to podcast@david-couch.com. I'll see you again next time.